Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We're joined today, this afternoon, for the rest of the hour by Heather Cox Richardson, a professor of history at Boston College and author of the Substack Letters from an American, the number one Substack. You need to go sign up for this. Refreshing historical context every day, which is so important to understanding this moment. Heather, we've talked about tariffs before, but we're going to do it again.
I'm laughing because this is why I'm here, Maggie. Like, you and I are tariffs, the only two tariffs, people in tariffs. The world who are like, we get to talk about tariffs.
Ooh, goody. Yes. Which is the best and so important to what's going on. I heard one of the main anchors on one of the evening shows say, I didn't know what Smoot-Hawley was until 6 months ago. Unfortunately, Heather, you and I both knew Smoot-Hawley before it became all the rage to talk about these days. But let's put all of this in context. First of all, tariffs used to be the purview of Congress. At least that's the way it was intended to be. Now, Donald Trump has used two acts that permit the declaration of emergencies to unilaterally seize control of U.S. tariff policy. Congress has permitted him to do so. The House, of course, slipping in a provision in the continuing resolution that kept our government funded that basically declared a day not to be a day so that the House of Representatives cannot be compelled to act to either uphold his emergency declaration or end it. Little thing that was stuck in there. And the Senate also has failed to act and exercise its constitutional duties to approve the president's tariff policy. But here we are, 145% tariffs on all goods from China, significant tariffs, 25 or greater percent on goods, specific goods coming in from Canada and Mexico, as well as retaliatory tariffs there. We're looking down the barrel of potentially more reciprocal tariffs, though we're unsure that those were on and then off again. So we don't know what's coming there. But help us all understand, Heather, when were tariffs embraced before? Donald Trump wistfully talks about these great times when our country was so wealthy. And I keep telling people he's talking about the Gilded Age, like with the robber barons. This is why we have antitrust and pro-competition laws today. So help people understand, Heather.
I will. I'd be happy to talk about that. But I have to say, I was surprised that the fact that the House of Representatives has changed the definition of a day so that Trump's tariffs cannot be challenged didn't get more outrage. I thought that was something that most people would be like, hey, come on here.
A day is not a day. I talked about it on my show because I thought it was so absurd. And again, they were wielding their power and authority to give away their power and authority,
which is in the Constitution, by the way. It is the Congress in the Constitution that has the power to levy tariffs. And as you say, Trump is doing it after declaring an emergency, which gives him the ability to adjust things. But of course, he's used them to make sweeping tariffs. So yeah, in fact, it's worth remembering that tariffs, as you and I both know, are not either good or bad. They're a tool. And they're a tool that can be used in different ways. And when Trump is talking about how much he loves President William McKinley, which by itself is a trip, let me tell you. Exactly.
A literal head scratcher if you're not watching us.
Yeah, McKinley, someday I will become a solely a historian again, and I can tell you stories about all these guys. But what McKinley did was he took what was the tariff system that the Republicans had set up during the Civil War to increase a tariff wall around the United States with the argument that that would help American industry by protecting it from foreign competition, which is the theory behind tariffs. But by the late 1890s, or not even late 1880s, the tariff walls were high enough that they allowed industrialists to collude to raise prices. And as we all know now, or if we don't, we all should, tariffs are paid by consumers. They are not paid by other countries. So what happened was essentially there was a transfer from the consumers in the country to the industrialists who were benefiting from these tariffs. So there's a huge fight in the late 19th century. If you remember your high school history classes, everybody was always fighting about the tariffs and you could not tell why. least for me, and mm-hmm. also silver, but that's a different story.
Yes.
And but the thing there is the tariffs become the symbol of the use of the government by industrialists to create a world that works for them alone. So there's huge fights over it. And that's how Grover Cleveland gets elected is in 1884, is he says, you know, we got to stop this. We got to adjust the tariffs. Well, so they fight about this and they talk about reforming the tariffs, you know, through the end of the 19th century. But finally, after the election of Woodrow Wilson in 1912, in 1913, he is the first effectively to lower tariffs and to replace the revenue that they brought in with an income tax. So he's taking some of the burden away from poorer Americans and putting it onto wealthier Americans. And this, I think, is, you know, the radical right has identified the 1913 Revenue Act as what they, the point they think that everything went to hell in a handbasket. Mm-hmm. Trump has certainly called for getting rid of an income tax. Yes. I think he has this vision that we can use tariffs to pay the expenses of the American government, and they will be able to get rid of an income tax, which of course disproportionately benefits those people at the very top of the economy. And somehow distribute the need, the fund, the revenue measures that we need to fund the government to the poorest Americans, which is what's going to happen. So this idea that somehow tariffs are going to make China pay for our goods, or now he's sort of changed that to say, well, we're not trading with China anymore, therefore we're saving billions of dollars, which is 100% not how trade works,
right,
is this fantasy of us rich guys are not going to have to pay taxes anymore. And somehow the money's going to materialize. Now, as you say, it's really interesting because people are already recognizing the tariff increases on the goods that they're buying. As somebody sent me a receipt the other day for $103 worth of yarn from China, which had $145 tariff on it. And this is somebody who's bought obviously in bulk for a long time and said, I'm not going to buy it at this cost. And this means I won't be able to get it. And American yarn is not going to fill the void there. And as over the course of this summer, as people recognize the extraordinary economic hit we will be taking from the tariffs, it will be interesting to see how many people stay behind Trump and his tariffs. You can see he's already sounding increasingly desperate, as he did on Sunday night on Air Force One. And you can also see his popularity dropping even in rural areas, some of which he has lost down to the point where there's people are about evenly pro and against him when they used to be quite in favor of the way that they thought he would govern. So the tariffs are going to be huge because of their impact, but they also should be huge because what they are saying is we need to go back, as you say, to the Gilded Age, where poor people bore the brunt of the cost of the federal government and rich people built the Newport mansions.
I call it regressive regressivism. And what I mean by that is it is regressive in two ways: a tax code that is increasingly regressive, meaning you actually are placing a higher and higher burden on the poorest among us to fund basic government functions, as opposed to a progressive system of income tax where the richest among us pay their fair share for the functions of government. By the way, they also consume and benefit from a lot of government functions at a scale and acuity level that is not comparable to folks on the lower end of the income scales. Think infrastructure, everybody. And regressive also because it harkens back to the time, the pre-FDR time period, where people lived in tenements. There was no 8-hour workday. Child labor was a thing. There were no safety guidelines. There were no environmental or clean air or water regulations, when it was almost a Hobbesian dystopic time in the United States if you were a working person. The only people who were having a grand old time in the Gilded Age were the people living in the gilded mansions. And that's what he's trying to sell to Americans today. It boggles the mind.
Well, it's also fascinating to me that really we never talk about what American lawmakers always talked about before the 1980s. And that's that if you are spending more money than you are bringing in, you need to raise taxes. That is always where they started. And it was the Republican Party that came up with that idea in 1861 and then throughout the Civil War. This idea that somehow the only answer always has to be cuts is just completely ahistorical, and a moment that really is part of the political project of the Reagan years and the Reagan Revolution. And it just is completely bizarre to me that we're looking at after a period in which from 1981 to 2021, We had the upward redistribution of wealth from the bottom 90% of American to the top 1% at the level of $50 trillion. You know, to me, as I'm watching everybody go, we've got to cut this. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, look at the size of this country and the relatively low taxation compared to any other developed country of the United States of America. And say, well, maybe what we really need to do is get rid of the George W. Bush tax cuts and the Donald Trump tax cuts. You get rid of both of those things. Think back to the Clinton administration when we had a budget surplus. You don't even have to go back to the Reagan tax cuts or the JFK tax cuts.
Post-World War II highest marginal income tax rate of 91%. Nobody's offering that. We're just saying get rid of the tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefited the wealthiest among us. Sorry to hop in here. Here's one of the statistics that you were tipping your hat to, Heather, is U.S. tax revenues as a percentage of GDP is the lowest amongst all G7 and OECD countries. And it's not close. It's like 1.5% here. The average, again, this is tax revenues as a percentage of GDP. The average in all other G7 and OECD countries, 25 to 30%. We're at a percentage, less than a percentage and a half. Really shows you what's going on here. Yeah, it is, when I show people, pick a statistic as an economist, and I just pick one. I don't care what it is. I can talk about union membership. I can talk about public school funding on a per capita inflationary adjusted basis. Ding, 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 ding. And you go back to around the beginning of the 80s, which incidentally and not coincidentally is 4 years after the Supreme Court penned the decision Buckley v. Vallejo legalizing corruption in this country. And you watch every single meaningful economic indicator on the health of the middle class start a nosedive after that period of time. And income and wealth inequality in this country, P.S. also globally, explode. I want to get to in our next segment, Heather, because this is so inherent in what we're talking about, is this idea of how far the MAGA movement has drifted from the birthplace, the fundamental ideals of conservatism. You pointed this out in one of your most recent Substacks about Edmund Burke as really sort of the theoretical founder of conservatism, as that term used to mean, at least in this country. And you pointed out how far the MAGA movement has come from that. We're going to continue that discussion, but tell us just a couple of the fundamental tenets. We've got about a minute left of what Edmund Burke was trying to set forth as the guideposts for what is now the Republican Party, however it may be conceived.
Edmund Burke was observing the French Revolution from the other side of the channel and took one look at the idea of trying to legislate based on an ideology rather than on reality, and said, this is a terrible idea because pretty soon you're going to try and make the people fit the ideology rather than the other way around.
So critical. He looked at governance through ideology as not a good outcome. My, how far modern Republicans and the MAGA movement has come. We're going to continue that discussion, and we're going to get into the outright historic levels of corruption. And by that, I mean we've never seen it quite like this at these levels, these dollar figures, and out loud and proud as we are these days. My guest is Heather Cox Richardson, historian, author. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Come back with us.